I'm Alec Baldwin.
And you're listening to Here's the Thing. Jeff Daniels is a genius of many genres. From a selfish intellectual in terms of endearment to Dumb and Dumber's big-hearted, small-brained pet groomer Harry Dunn, Daniels has had one of the most varied careers in Hollywood, or in Central Michigan, for that matter. He grew up in rural Washtenaw County, raised to take over the family wood business. His life changed when he was spotted at a summer program by Marshall Mason of New York's trailblazing Circle Repertory Theater Company. Plucked from a life in lumber, he never waited tables. Jeff Daniels was a working actor from the start, even if it meant a few years of doing commercials.
Suddenly, the honeymoon was over.
Mashed potatoes. Now, that's unusual.
So I tried tater tots, or at his different brand.
Daniels has always balanced stage and screen. He took on the lead role in A.R. Gurney's The Golden Age on Broadway the year after his Hollywood breakthrough in James Brooks' Terms of Endearment. He's back on stage now in his brilliant reimagining of Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, for which he's been nominated for a Tony. Broadway's schedule is brutal, and Daniels has been fighting a cold, but he is firmly in the school of the show must go on.
When you're above the title, there's a responsibility and an obligation with that. And especially with Atticus Finch and Mockingbird, there are people who have bought tickets 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And I know the choice. I know what they do. I mean, if you're the star of it and you can't be 100%, and there might be Tony voters out there, you bag it. And you just let everybody know, and you just go, I'm not going to go out there less than my best. And I've gone out there 50%. And this vocal thing, it was a mucus thing. It was 2 weeks long. And there were shows I sounded like Bill Clinton in a close-up. I did the whole closing argument in a close-up. and I found a way to make it work for them. And they forgive you. They can see that you're struggling. Most of them go, he went on,
right,
versus the understudy, which is bad for the understudy. But I've said the only way I'm not going on is if I'm bleeding out.
Well, first of all, thank you for doing this on your one day off.
Hardly heavy lifting.
But as I recall, on that one day off, either you had 90 things to do or you did nothing. You ran around a million errands.
I've come to absolutely nothing.
Nothing. But what I want to begin by asking was, what was the genesis of you in the play? How did that start in terms of you playing this part?
I had done Newsroom with Aaron Sorkin. I had done the Jobs movie with Aaron. And it was similar with the Newsroom thing was a meeting with Scott Rudin and Aaron, and by the end of the breakfast meeting, I had it. Jobs was Aaron turning to me in the third season of Newsroom and going, look, I'm doing Jobs. Do you want to play John Scully? I said, sure. Send me the script when it's ready. But I was already, with Aaron, I'm in. It's the same thing with Mockingbird. We were doing press for Jobs, and Aaron and I were both there, and he just turned to me and he said, Scott Rudin has finally, after years, gotten the rights, and would you like to play Atticus Finch on Broadway? I should read the book, was my, response. But inside I was going, what just happened?
And how hard did you have to think about that?
I didn't blink. I'm too old to worry about it. And I've said, the last 5 years, 10 years maybe, it's if I'm not challenged, then good night. I'm done.
Especially in the theater.
Anywhere. That's why I think Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and all these, where all the writers are going. Oh, thank God. Otherwise, I'd be out. And so immediately I knew it was a great challenge, and it was Broadway. And it was Aaron, back to Broadway, and Scott Rudin's world-class producer.
Yep.
And I said, I'm in. I'll figure out how to do it from now on. And Gregory Peck and everything that he accomplished with the role, not only, the Oscar and all of that, but also in people's mind, hearts and minds, I was ready to just take that on and figured out a way to do it.
Now, Sorkin, who I did this movie Malice years ago that he wrote in the early stages of his career, when he was doing a lot of writing for Castle Rock, and I was going to do another project that he was involved with recently that fell apart. A Few Good Men, live on TV for NBC. They were going to do it live, but that didn't happen. But I mean, he's known as somebody who's very demanding. You know, he likes everything his way. Was Newsroom the first time you worked with him?
Mm-hmm. Met him at the meeting, and you know, first day on the set was day one.
What do you think someone like Sorkin, who, let's assume he could pretty much have anybody he wants, what do you think he sees in you? What does he want in you for these parts that you've played for him?
You know, I live in the Midwest. You're knee-deep in decency and honesty and respect for other people and all that kind of repressed kind of Protestant. And I don't know. Maybe that permeates me. I don't know what it was about Newsroom. They did ask. He and Scott asked. He said, I've never seen you angry. So I told a story where I ended up getting angry and I banged the table in the Four Seasons, you know, breakfast area, and people turned and looked, and I had the part. I also can handle his dialogue, so there's the whole technical aspect of that.
Was Sorkin in the room during the rehearsals much?
Yeah, he was around. It's painful for the playwright.
But he deferred to the director.
Oh, yeah.
He let the director direct.
They would bring him in, and there were note sessions with Scott Rudin and Bart Scheer and Aaron, I think, every Saturday morning or Saturday mornings when
that's
Aaron
a meeting
was
I love to have been at with a documentary camera.
Oh my God,
Scott Rudin, Bart
8 in the morning.
Oh God,
yeah, there were, and we got rewrites. November 1st, first preview, 45 previews. December 13th, opening, and we had rewrites, lots and lots of rewrites, restagings. It was November was a tough month.
Did you do a lot of research? Did you feel you had to do a lot of research to play the part, or no?
I read the book, and then I read the book again and highlighted the Atticus stuff and then put it down and never looked at it again.
And for people who don't know, who haven't read the book, how different is the book from the film?
She goes all over the place in the book, and the film is a lot more streamlined. The movie is told from the kid's point of view, looking up at Atticus, the great white savior.
The white protagonist in the civil rights movie.
Yeah. You know, that was one of the things that Aaron talked about in the movie. He loses the case to Tom Robinson. And then as he's packing up his briefcase, he goes out and the colored pastor stands up and tells everyone to stand up. Your father's passing. And, you know, growing up, Aaron had said, oh, what a scene. But today, no. No, they wouldn't. Thanks for trying really hard. And he's going to go to the electric chair now. But thank you. Thanks for trying. You're one of the good whites. Wouldn't cut it now.
So that's something you didn't miss.
No.
I mean, everybody was of one mind as
and
to
that's
why
one
that was
where
out.
The play changes dramatically from the book and the movie.
I just was saying before you got here, we're trying to think of what are the things in the movie that are not in the play.
Yeah.
And that's one of them.
Oh, and then we go on what would basically be the act three of a play in a lot of different directions. We basically slap Atticus around until he realizes that maybe there isn't goodness in everyone.
Right. You know, they say the N-word a lot in this play. I mean, they lay it out there. They must say it.
Atticus says it.
Yeah. Was there a lot of discussion about that or no?
Not really. I mean, sure, it was. There was some sensitivity training, you know, in early rehearsals. But basically, it's actors. And this is what Mayella, that's how she refers to him. It's how Bob Yule refers, is how Sheriff Heck Tate refers to him. It's common
in
1934. So, you know, as actors, you kind of slide into that, you know. And when you're on stage doing it, that's when it's used. And that's the only time it's used.
In 1992, when I did Streetcar, we said, you know, are we going to do the play or are we going to do a revisionist version of the play? Because I'm going to smack my wife across the face and within 5 minutes she's back in bed with me. What are we going to do?
Right.
Are we going to do that? You know, it's not easy to play that.
No, we get that too. We get a reaction from the audience today when certain parts of the play are, you know, kind of thrown out there. And it's normal for 1934 Alabama, but you can hear the reaction a little bit. Sometimes.
So if we are going to go back in time a little bit, how come you didn't take over the lumber company? What happened?
It involved caring about wood. in a way that I wasn't capable of. I wasn't wired that way. And God knows my dad tried. For 4 summers, I drove truck in the yard. Get there at 7:30 in the morning, go till 5:30. You're taking 16-foot pieces of drywall upstairs around corners. And when they snap, you have to take it back on the truck. You're driving around corners with 200 cement block on the back of a flatbed. You're listening to the Allman Brothers on your little AM, FM, you know, 1970s action version of a boombox. And you go around and you see out of the side mirror 200 cement blocks rolling on a guy's lawn that you had just taken the corner a little too hot. I just didn't care. I just couldn't care. He put me in algebra. He put me in trigonometry. I would study with him. We'd pull a D. It just...
What about your brother? What's he like?
Hmm?
What does he do, your brother?
He runs the lumber company. He runs the lumber. And
he got
it's
it
doing
right.
Quite well, thanks. He's more of a kind of a gambler. He's kind of a, he understands money far better than I do. And it should be his. It should be. Fate. Helped out my dad, so the lumber company continues on despite my dad's efforts.
Oh, my God.
It would have been, it just would have been one of those.
You're a dreamer.
It's just my mom majored in art at Eastern Michigan University, so that's where I get it. It's that, I got to create.
You can't have a regular job.
I can't. Once you start to understand you're creating a character in a musical in a community theater or college or whatever, and boom, you start to go down that road. It's like the sharks. You got to keep moving. Whether I'm doing acting or guitar or writing a play for my theater company, I know that's what I'm supposed to be doing, and luckily have done it for decades.
So when you get summoned, well, you can describe it, to go to Circle Rep, to a program they had in the summer, that was your first sojourn into that?
Yeah, I had done musicals in high school. That's all they did. We had a summer theater program run by the same high school director where we do more and more musicals. I did Harold Hill. I did Fagin and Oliver. I did Tevye on Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
I would have killed to see that.
Oh, my God.
Sky Masterson?
If only. No?
No?
No, I was Big Julie in Guys and Dolls. Big Julie, walk out. Stand there with the arms crossed, legs spread, big, you know, Guys and Dolls suit, got a fedora, got a fake cigar, and then walk off stage, intermission. The director comes up and says, your zipper's down. To this day, I'm triple checking that fly. So I went to Central Michigan University basically to do dramas. I kept being told that you're good, you should chase it. Okay, well, let's go to Central. Because I didn't have the grades to get into Michigan or Michigan State. And a friend of mine was at Central and he needed a roommate. And I'd won some awards there. And then I was in the library one day and I was reading the CM Life daily newspaper, student paper, auditions at Eastern Michigan University, downstate at Ypsilanti, for Play Rep Festival, and da-da-da-da-da, kids from all over the state auditioning. Okay, let's go see how I do. So I'll go there, fail, not get in. I got tickets to the Red Wings that night anyway in Detroit, so I'll go to Detroit, get drunk, it'll be great. And then I got called back, and I remember one of the Central Michigan guys said, where are you going? I said, I got Red Wing tickets. Well, you were called back. Yeah, but my roommates are waiting. He goes, you idiot, you. One of the directors is from New York. His name is Marshall W. Mason. He's out here. I came to find out doing a favor for the guy who runs the theater department at Eastern. He used to go to college with the guy. The guy said, come on out, direct some college kids, pick up a check. Marshall said, okay. You're called back for the lead in his play. You're not going to a hockey game. Okay. Went in, auditioned. People would stand there with their scripts, you know, very presentational. And then Marshall said, yes, I'd just like to see one person, Jeff Daniels, come on up. And he pointed to the girl. Okay, sit in 2 chairs, 3 feet apart, face each other, read the scene. You know, close-ups. And I, you know, instinctively knew not to play it to a room of 100 kids and just played it to her. She played it to me, and Marshall said, thank you. That's it. We're done. And cast me in the lead in Tennessee
what
Williams,
show?
Summer and Smoke.
Summer and Smoke. There, at Ypsilanti.
in Ypsilanti, college kids.
No.
And by the time we were heading up to the first performance, he took me out. I want to take you out for a second, talk to you. I said, sure, yeah. I mean, that's the New York director. And I, by this point, I knew that he was the artistic director of Circle Rep in New York City, where Lanford Wilson was, where, you know, we had done one of the four plays was How to Baltimore.
Tanya Barrison.
But it was that legendary New American Play place. And I was, oh, wow, this guy's something. And he took me out and he said, basically, you know what you should do with your life, don't you? I said, well, you know, I'd like to be an actor. He goes, you should come to New York and be an apprentice at the Circle Rep. I'm not promising you anything. There are no obligations, nothing. But you have the talent to try. You decide. So I went home to my lumberyard father and farmer housewife mother. But they could see that there was something going on. And they were told there was something going on. He turned to my mom and looked at me and said, you should go. Which meant no senior year at Central Michigan. Get in the car and go to New York at 21. And I did.
And you see how in your career, you play what you're asked to play. The young guy, the innocent guy. You play Flap. You play, you know, the part where you're not putting all the pieces together. You're not the sharpest guy in the room, whatever. And then you turn around and you're playing Atticus Finch. You know what I mean? There's a way we move toward a kind of integrity. There's a kind of a, I don't like the word gravitas. I think that's, but there's an authority.
That's been used.
Of course.
And a lot of it was, gravitas has been, you got, you know, I remember some guy, I mean, Ron Maxwell for Gettysburg, just, I got to find out if you got the balls.
Yeah. The authority is for me.
And it was, I really studied Jack Lemmon. I really studied Dick Van Dyke. They were early inspirations for me that pushed me towards the guy who walks into the wall and now is, you know, dizzy, and the guy who's trying to figure out things, that not the hero, not the guy with the square jaw standing there doing that. I was always, that's who influenced me. And so that's what I would attack things with. Something wild is Jack Lemmon and Dick Van Dyke had a baby and it was called Me. That's what it is. And there's no gravitas in that, you know, or at least what I interpreted from them and ran with. And I remember having those conversations with agents and stuff, and, you know, and then Newsroom came along, which is probably the first one.
You think so?
Probably.
The first one where you were asked to play?
I mean, there were others, you know, Fly Away Home, maybe. Certainly Gettysburg, the guy came to have that kind of steel. But it was definitely, I was comfortable being the flawed hero. It goes all the way back to Flap, the flawed character, which is what all we played off-Broadway. Nobody played a rock, square-jawed Tom Cruise hero.
No.
You didn't, you would kick that off-Broadway.
They don't write that
day.
In the theater. So one of the first films you made was with Milos in Ragtime. Did you have much of a relationship with him at all?
He was very nice to me. It was my first movie. Must have been scared to death. The only direction he gave me was, you move your mouth. You're moving your mouth. When you're not talking, you're not speaking, you move your mouth. Don't move your mouth.
That's it.
That was it. And it was, you know, nerves. It was lip movement. It was, you know, smirking. I don't know what I was doing. It was just a nervous twitch or something. That was cool because to watch Milos get the performance out of Cagney in his early 80s, mm-hmm. He didn't want to do it.
Woody, two movies with Woody, didn't talk much to you.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I worked with him, no Woody, no talking.
Well, good to hear.
Right.
That's why I won't take it personally.
Right.
There was, and you were told that going in.
Yeah.
Don't try to be his friend. Don't try to tell jokes.
Don't
try
much.
To make him laugh. Don't just do your job.
Right.
Got it. And, you know, and you get the script, which no one can see, and you realize you're playing two leading roles in a Woody. Oh, my God. Okay, everything I've ever learned, please let me remember now. Go. There was one thing, though, on Purple Rose. They hired me so quickly. Michael Keaton had been doing it, and I mutually agreed to not do it anymore, is what I was told, so fine. I came in, auditioned, got it on a Thursday, was shooting on a Monday. Fully prepared to be fired in a month.
Sure.
Wasn't. 2 months in, with a month to go. Now we're in. Now they can't fire me. We do a thing where I'm singing a song in a music shop with Mia. No one had asked if I could sing. Jeffrey Kurlin, costume director, sure. designer, came back to the dressing room before we were going to shoot the scene or even rehearse it that morning. He goes, by the way, can you sing? You can sing, right? And I'm going, they don't know. They don't know. So I went out in the rehearsal, and I couldn't find the note. Key of A, I'm in B flat, I'm in E flat,
you're going to get fired.
Could I just hear it again? I'm sorry.
You're going to get fired. Michael Keaton was a better singer than you.
By this point, they're going, no, by this point, it was like, he can't sing. Okay, well, lip sync it. Woody's over there going, I'm Alabama, bound. Where is it? There it is. Yeah, thanks. Once more, please. Once more. And then, you know, once they had sweated enough, having made me sweat for 3 months, now I'm Judy Garland.
You're right. Now you're Bing Crosby.
Now I'm Bing Crosby, yeah.
Well, the thing with him, when I did Blue Jasmine, I had a small part in Blue Jasmine, and we're doing a scene that he later cut from the film where Cate Blanchett and I are in the kitchen, a big, big, fancy kitchen of an estate on Long Island. And he says to me, and he wanted me to ad-lib something. He said, you know, say to her, you know, perhaps she should go back to that doctor, go see that doctor that she had been seeing, you know, before. you know, just say some name. And I go, Dr. Fetterman. And he went, nothing funny. And so when you're with him, it's church and state. It's funny or it ain't funny. Yeah. The drama, not funny.
Not funny.
He didn't want anything funny. I mean, Cate Blanchett smokes a cigarette, or I don't even know if she smoked, but that's my memory of it. You know, Tooch downs an espresso, comes in, and we have a fight, a physical fight. And he goes, I'm really sorry, but you know, you're supposed to be at your wit's end here. You're supposed to be coming apart. And I'm just not seeing it. Take two, a couple of espressos. She's clawing at me. I'm throwing her on the couch. We're having a physical fight. I'm really sorry, darling, but I'm just not getting it. You're really supposed to be, you're going out of your mind here. And he made her do it again and again. She was like 9 times. And by the 9th and 10th time, you know, we needed a straitjacket for her. She was so flipped out. But she won the Oscar. You know, she won the Oscar for Best Actress.
The good ones are merciless.
The good ones are merciless.
They really are.
What about Brooks?
Madman genius. In love with the next idea, in love with writing. He thinks like no one else thinks. He was one of the great writing minds I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that. I remember just being wowed by him, that brilliance, which went all over the place. I mean, sometimes in a crazy way, and then he comes back, and it's only Jim Brooks would think of this. Do that.
There's a lot of big personalities on that film.
Yeah.
How good was he at marshaling all those people on the set? Or did he even bother trying?
I think he did the absolute best he could in a situation where you had two titans. One at the peak of her career, Deborah Winger, and Shirley, who still had it going on but was further down the road and was, you know, it was about whose movie it was going to be. I mean, this is all stuff as an off-Broadway actor and in one of his first movies is just shut up and listen.
Yeah.
Who gets the close-up? You know, when they put that tape measure in the old days on the close-up on you and it's 4'8", and then they turn around on her and it's 3'6".
Which girls, I never thought about that.
These girls knew those things, you know? But I think also with Deborah, merciless. She was not going to do some gauzy mother-daughter relationship. It was going to be love-hate. And her style of working is that if that has to occur off-camera as well, then that's what we'll do.
I adore her.
Yeah, I do too.
She's
came
so
to Mockingbird a couple months ago. Very, very nice of her. And she's not the only one who does that. I mean, she was the first one that I was confronted with, with who used that approach. I've since been around some other people who will do something in the first week of a 12-week shoot to jar our relationship.
Without giving names, for example, how do you jar the relationship?
You surprise them with, and this happened to me. My first day on the set, they'd been shooting for 2 months already. And this other actor, we have an adversarial relationship in the movie. And we were doing a big group photo. And I put my hand on his shoulder and said, how you doing? He goes, don't ever touch me again. You and blah, 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 blank, blank, blank. I mean, just in front of about 10 people. First day.
What was his problem?
He's method. He had some issues, but he was also, I'd read that he was method and all that. So I didn't know which it was. He's either got anger issues
or both.
Or it's, you know what?
He's a method asshole.
But that's the relationship in the movie. Right. And I said, you know, done. Good. Thanks for the help. I said, it was just a joke. And walked past him, didn't speak to him for 2 months.
Yeah.
On the set.
Yeah.
Nothing. In the makeup trailer, I'm walking down towards hair. You need to move. You know, just walking towards him, and he would go out the other door and then come around the other door and go into the makeup chair.
Yeah.
I used it, and so did he.
Yeah.
And if that's the rule on this movie, that's the rule.
I've had the opposite with Nichols. Nichols was so kind to me. He was so kind to me. And really the scenes, he loved them and seemed to take time with them. What was your experience with him?
Another genius. It was a scene with Meryl and Mike, you know, like as he should. It was Meryl's movie and Jack's movie. It was called Heartburn.
Right.
And so I was supporting in it. So he was very kind, very respectful, but it was about Meryl, and I knew it was about Meryl. And don't. I have a question. You don't have a question. No, you don't. But to be around him and just to listen to him work with Meryl in a two shot, and try this, try that, try that. And
that's
again,
it,
it's the
said.
Same thing that Jonathan Demme had, that Jim Brooks had. And Woody has that you would you only they would think to do that. Only the great directors think of that. You've thought of everything, and then they think of something and go, "Try this," and you wouldn't have thought of that. And that's the one, that's the choice. Nichols was like that, and to see Mike and Meryl try things and miss, swing and miss, what an education!
The great gift you mentioned. What do you learn supporting roles? The great gift you get is what you just said: is to observe, to watch other people.
Observe, learn how to behave on camera and off, and time. Get it in two, and if you can get it in one, even better. And the two shot with Meryl in Heartburn, where we're both on the couch and she can't figure out what to do, and Mike is not working, and Mike's going, "I know it isn't, and what it is, and it's six, and it's seven, and you're sweating bullets because you know the two shot we're going to use, the take we're going to use, is the one where she's great. So you got to be great eight times. She's got to be great once."
This is a film acting class, folks.
Jeff Daniels says there are both challenges and opportunities in playing second fiddle. Besides Heartburn, he also took a supporting role in The Hours, starring Julianne Moore as a miserable housewife and mother. I spoke to Moore about her own very different experience of motherhood.
We have an incredibly tolerant business toward women with children, I have to say. Thank goodness for the movie business. I remember my son was, when I was doing Psycho, as a matter of fact, my son was 9 months old and I was still getting used to having a baby and he was always with me and stuff. And he was hysterical in the trailer one day and I was nursing him and trying to get him to calm down. And they knocked on the trailer door and they said, you know, we need you. And I was like, they said, my baby's crying, I can't come.
Yeah.
And this adorable PA said, no worries, man, take your time.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy cow, I'm the luckiest woman in the world.
The rest of that interview at heresthething.org. More Jeff Daniels coming up. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Jeff Daniels and I both worked on The Looming Tower, Alex Gibney's series about the lead-up to 9/11. Each episode had a different director, something Daniel said he was used to.
I think I learned it on Newsroom because I knew there was a revolving door of directors. Five words or less. If you can't tell me what you want in the next take in five words or less, stay in the chair. Don't come near me. Because I'll do it. I've been a supporting actor. I know how to direct myself. I'm going to come in with some choices that I think this might be what it is, and you might want to see those. I'm not going to talk about them. I don't talk about them well. Five words or less. And they did that. And I'll do anything you want. You want me to get angry on take four just to see who knows? I'll absolutely. All you'll hear from me is, okay.
Well, don't ever say to me, give me one that I don't want to do just so I can have it. And then I say, well, what if you use it? You know what I mean? There are directors I've worked with who I would acquiese. If Woody told me, I would do whatever Woody asked me. I'd do whatever Marty asked me. But there are directors who they haven't earned that. And I'm like, I want you to have what you want. I want to get it. I want to get your part.
On Newsroom and Looming Tower and Godless and all that stuff, I come in ready. I come in prepared. So usually if I've done my homework and prepped it and all that, it's kind of what it should be in the first one or two or three. And so then it's just a matter, and what I usually get is, do you want to do another one? No, I'm done. I'm done. And the best ones are the takes that you don't remember what you just did, where it's you're chasing impulses. I really don't try to freeze it. I really don't try to, even Mockingbird moves around, and Bart Shearer, the director, has given me a little latitude on that. Don't deviate from the story or the direction, but stay in the lane, but you can weave around a little bit. And I do, and that's film. One is different than two, is different than three, then different than four. That comes from not being in the editing room. How do I control that? I've seen stars go, yeah, I need to see the cut. I need to see, I'm not sure.
Video playback.
Playback, good God. I remember doing a movie and the star, again, I was brought in to help make her better and take one, and then she goes to playback and it's 3 minutes. Mm. And take two, and then she goes to playback. And it wasn't going well anyway. And she came back, she goes, why don't you go to watch playback? I said, we don't have playback on Broadway.
I love playback if we're flipping a car.
Yeah, you know, but it's between stunts, action and cut. Right, that's where it is.
Scenes, yeah.
And editor, they're all going to decide it's not going to be where we think it is. And Sigourney Weaver told me that. Great lesson. The movie you have in your head is not going to be the movie that you see. And the sooner you learn that, the easier this career will be.
The Farrelly Brothers.
And he won the Oscar.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. There either is a God or there isn't. I don't know what that means. Yeah. You're going, you guys are Harry and Lloyd. You're Harry and Lloyd.
I would work with them again tomorrow.
Oh, sure. Their energy. Pete and Bobby's energy on a set. It's just a great day at work when you go with them. In Dumb and Dumber 2, I walk into my trailer and all of a sudden there's Bill Murray sitting in my trailer. Bill. How are you? Yeah, I'm coming in here to do a cameo. Oh, are you? Hey.
We're sharing a dressing room.
Yeah. Well, no, he was just being nice. No. And then he went over. But we went in, and it's Harry and Lloyd back in their apartment and the worm farm and all of that. But the kitchen has now been turned into a meth lab. And there's Bill Murray in a hazmat suit. But you can't see him.
Great cameo. Isn't the cameo
It's like going to get De Niro for a cameo and letting him play a dead guy on the sidewalk with his face down on the sidewalk. That's what the Farrelly Brothers would do.
Now, you moved back to Michigan. You had a two-year-old. And what was the thinking? Where were you at career-wise then?
I didn't want fame. I didn't want stardom. I was scared to death.
What do you mean by that? That demands an explanation.
I wasn't comfortable in situations with a lot of famous people making career moves at a party. I couldn't schmooze. I was the guy against the wall. Just put me in the audition room and I'll beat you. But I can't
outfame you.
I can't outfame. I can't do this.
Oh, boy.
So now I get to quit. Or I think I just realized that if that's what it takes, then I'm going to go back to the lumber company.
Okay, but that's essential. So at the time you moved back, what had you just made and what was the impact? You just shot what?
I had just shot and probably been released The Purple Rose of Cairo. Terms of Endearment was out. Maybe Marie with Sissy Spacek.
So you were on a streak. Movies that were making your career.
Yeah.
Movies that were making your career. Yes. And like all the many people, myself included, have that failure is much more familiar to me than success.
Yes.
So when everything is going really, really well is when especially you sit there and go, I don't think I really, really want this. Was that
I didn't want the stardom. I didn't want the fame. I wanted to be a really good actor. That's all I wanted to be. I knew that was, I later learned, that's all I could control. I can't control this other thing. I have a wife. I have a two-year-old boy.
What'd your wife say?
She's from Michigan. Both of our families are back there in this little town. We had gone back the previous three summers leading up to 1986, the move back. We went back for a month in the summer. The next summer, went back from Memorial Day to Labor Day. The third summer, I was there mid-April.
From Halloween to St. Patrick's Day.
Almost Halloween, October. I said, we just spent 6 months in Michigan, and I answered the phone, and occasionally I got in an airplane, went to New York and met somebody. Why do I have to live in New York where I can't afford the apartment? And I'm
what did your wife think about what you were doing? She's your wife, who you've been with forever.
Neither one of us knew.
She supported you.
Yeah. And more importantly, the agent supported me.
I was going to ask you that.
The agent said, you want to what? I said, yeah, I want to move to Michigan and just do the movie career out of there. No, you can't. Okay. I wasn't like Tom Cruise on the cover of Newsweek, but there were offers. They said, if you're willing to get on an airplane at your own expense from Detroit to LA just to do meetings, and we can couch them in a week, then okay, live wherever you want. I said, okay, deal. And early on, for about 3 years, they came my way to have movie people sitting on my little boat on this little lake, you know, driving around trying to talk me into doing a movie. Was like, wow. I remember getting a FedEx from Woody Allen, script for Radio Days. Wow.
Yours is a very dramatic version of this, which is there's people who they self-immolate. People will ask me about commerce versus the artistic, and I'll say, movie stardom isn't for everybody. But a lot of people, then they stay in L.A., and they stay there, where someone's walking up, pulling your pants down, sticking a thermometer up your ass, and taking your temperature every 15 minutes to tell you how hot you are or not, which is why I don't want to live there. Which is why I don't want to fucking live there. Because I just can't handle, you know, that. The L.A. drives me insane that way. But the...
That actually happens, by the way.
I've got video footage to prove it. But my point is, for you, when you decided that you wanted that change, you didn't want to chase that thing, and you move... And you're still there. You still live there.
I do. We have a wonderful apartment here in New York, but that's it. That's the two of them. The family's back there.
What are your three kids doing?
I didn't trust it. I didn't trust Hollywood. I didn't trust the movie career. I had three, four great movies. They're movies that were, you know, of importance. But I didn't trust that it would last. You know, Goodman. I read somewhere John Goodman said, the limo that you're riding in tonight is rented, you know. Somebody else's ass is going to be in it tomorrow. And I always, you know, it was all so temporary.
Well, I mean, I've said this in this book I wrote. I started making movies in 86. And as I go through the 80s, I'm getting to be 4 or 5 years sober. All of it has the whiff of like of getting high. It's another high I'm chasing.
Very intoxicating. Look at social media now. Yeah. Look at the YouTube stars now. Look at all the people. You can just see them chasing it. See them wanting. And you learn as you grow older. I'm often asked, when did you know that you made it? One of my answers is, it's when you're at the Golden Globes in 1985 for Purple Rose. And Michael J. Fox is up for Back to the Future. And you're both up in the same category. And I don't want to be there. I got the guard up. This is the last place I want to be. I want to be, this is everything I don't want. And I'm sitting there, and Michael J. Fox, and there's a few stars that have done this, walked across and said, hi, I'm Michael. Nice to meet you. Oh, nice. Yeah, nice to meet you. He goes, I said, you're what a Back to the Future. How great for you. And he goes, I'm the star, but you're the actor. You know? And that's not on a billboard. That's not something you're going to see, you know, in the Star School book of what making it is. And Michael's a terrific actor. But for him to say something like that, you know, that mattered. And then it, you know, went away. And then I had to scramble.
When did it go away in your mind?
I made a bunch of movies no one saw.
Right. For the dough.
No.
No. Script. Movies you believed in. Okay.
The script.
Got it. Got
and not even, you know, later on, Squid and the Whales, things like that. This was Love Hurts with Bud Yorkin. Nice comedy that went belly up. Checking Out with David Leland. Joe Esterhaus wrote the first draft of it. And you know, nine great little independent movies. I fell in love with independent movies. And they didn't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I had to scramble, and I said, I need to do a movie that someone sees.
Mm-hmm.
And we got Arachnophobia.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Marshall directed it. It was his first directing thing. You know, the studio didn't think it would do much. And then it tested great. And they said it's going to make $100 million. And then
you and John.
Huh?
You and John, right?
Goodman. Yeah, John was in it. And he brought star power to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up making about $80 million. And, you know, it was like enough back then. It was enough to, like, get back in. But then I was still scrambling. And I got Gettysburg, which was really just a four-hour, two-night TV thing on
TNT. Who directed that?
Ron Maxwell.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was, I need to shake this up. And that's when I went out and I auditioned for about three movies, one of which was Dumb and Dumber.
Which made $250 million.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. That must have felt good.
That was the transition from going through an airport from, who are you? To Jeff Daniels.
Right.
Suddenly, they knew my name.
And when you came back to do the sequel to that, which was how many years later?
20? I think it was 20.
Whose idea was that? Like, how does the sequel idea come up 20 years later? And they get the two of you to do it. Both of you have a lot going on.
They get Jim to do it.
Right. Right.
I'm like, call me when you're ready.
Right.
So I love the Farrellys. I love Jim. So with me, it was just, we were doing Newsroom, I think, second season. And all of a sudden, it's real. And it's coming. Now we're doing deals. And it's like, okay, and we're going to shoot it this summer or in the fall, whenever it was going to shoot it. I'm going, I'm all in. This is great. This is great.
Yeah.
I won the Emmy. The surprise win. Surprise win.
Why? Why do you say that? Who were you up against?
You had Spacey in House of Cards.
Right.
You had Damian Lewis in Homeland. You had Brian in Breaking Bad. Who am I forgetting? John Hamm, Mad Men.
And they all canceled each other out.
I don't know, but Newsroom and HBO said, just be glad you're going. Just be really, you know, enjoy the fact that you get to go.
You're sitting in the balcony.
You get a nice seat, enjoy the seat. Because, you know, Gandolfini, not until the third year did he win. So, first year. Just don't get your hopes up. Got it.
And the winner is.
Yeah. And
how did you
won
feel?
It on a Sunday night.
Right.
Was on a plane Monday morning for Atlanta and was dressed as Harry Dunn in Dumb and Dumber on a Tuesday morning,
can you believe
day
that?
One of shooting.
That's this business.
Yeah.
Do you feel that in some sense, everything you've done and the choices you made and the things you didn't do have led to where you are now with this play?
Yeah, everything. It's the role. Atticus Finch is the role of a lifetime. And in order to pull off everything that the entire team pulled off, including me at least having someone, a version of Atticus Finch that isn't beneath Gregory Peck's. Does it stand next to him? That's all I ask. Everything you've ever learned, all the stage technique that's taken decades to learn, how to pull an audience in, when to push them away, the timing, how to read different audiences. Oh, you're listening tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Quiet.
Great. I'm going to pull you in even further. It varies. It changes. And the other actors watch, you know, they go with me, you know, and this, it can only come from having done this for decades, decades.
What's the toughest part of the play for you? Acting wise, what's the part of the play where you think I really got to find something here?
There are a series of scenes that start with the closing argument that become this kind of tumble down the hill towards the bottom for Atticus, where he finally gives up and says, yes, I know. You're all right and I'm wrong. So that's a tumble, but it's the part of the play I enjoy the most because I don't know what I'm going to find. The closing argument is different every night. Every night. It's been wildly ferocious. It's been quiet. I chase impulses inside it. And that's when acting is fun. That's between action and cut. It's pulling you this way, and you go, and you chase it, and you go, and you go. Now you're with Tom Robinson. Now you're turning to the other lawyer, and you're chewing him out. Maybe you might want to think about what you're doing for a living, because this isn't shame on you, you know? And then you talk to the audience, and you know, and it's alive. It's alive. Mm-hmm. Almost 6 months into the run, and it's still that way. I'm fascinated to see if it sustains for the year that I'm in this. I'm so appreciative of what the opportunity I've got. Everybody wanted this part. Everybody. They made phone calls. Everybody.
How great that you're going to do it for a year. That's amazing. That's very old school. Do it for a year.
Yeah, it's Atticus Finch. How Fonda did Mr. Roberts for a year. Lee J. Cobb did Death of a Salesman, I think, for over. I mean, that's what the old guys used to do. And I've done those 18-weekers, you know, which is, that's terrific. But this one kind of demanded that you stay in it at least, you know, 7 months to get to the
There's an
Tonys.
Audience for it, yeah.
Because you know there's going to be a drive for the Tonys. And so now you're 7 months. And Mockingbird, summer, family show, yeah. If it wins Best Play, then I can, okay, all right, summer in New York, why not?
But
now you're 9 months, and let's make it a year and see if you can do it. See if you can sustain it and keep it alive without veering all over the road in months 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see that.
Is there something you need to do physically? Are there some kind of regimen you're doing? You're on your feet the whole goddamn thing. It's almost 3 hours.
Well, there's that. There's the half-hour walk you don't need to do. It is an endurance test.
Yep.
And so that means you have to treat it like an athlete. You have to not train so much physically, but your voice needs to be able to last 8 shows a week. So how do we do that? And you work with the vocal thing, and you learn how to throw it up and nasally and all that, like singers do, even though we're mic'd. You eat right. I don't go out. I don't drink. I'm worried about September and October.
You never go to dinner after the show?
No.
You don't?
I go home.
Oh, you go home. That's it.
I go home. It's the obligation. I can't. I'm glad I don't drink. I don't come in hungover,
right?
And try to get through it, you know. And they're paying how much a ticket? Oh well, what do I care?
A lot.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, we do student matinees. We've done a couple of them where it's 1,400 kids, and that's a whole different show. They listen. They're great. They, you know, when I have a fight scene with Bob Ewell later on, and I grab him by the hair. It's 30 seconds of, whoa, kick his ass, oh, wow.
That's a big change from the movie.
30 seconds. Yeah, and it's, but they're into it. But there's also the student, I don't have to do those. I can call in. Let Tom do it. Let the understudy do it. Give him a chance to do it. But I do the student matinees. And part of the reason I do it is not just for the kids, but the teachers. My daughter's a public school teacher. And those teachers are bringing these kids. They can't afford a Broadway ticket. And this is their chance to see Mockingbird on a Thursday at 1 o'clock at a student matinee.
They're never going to forget
it. Rock and roll. Who can, you know, everybody be quiet for a little bit, audience. And you do it for them.
They're never going to forget it.
No. No.
When young people, they take them to the theater, they never forget it. The first plays I saw when I was a kid, I'll never forget it.
And these kids, in the last third of the play, they're right with us. Right with us. So they're listening. It's pretty cool.
I did Streetcar on Broadway, and I'm in my room, and I never thought about Brando. Never. And then opening night comes, and I'm in my room, and I go, what the fuck have I done? And Greg Mosher walks in and says, Marlon Brando is 300 pounds. And he's in a house up on Mulholland Drive, and he's not coming down here to do Streetcar on Broadway tonight. Because if this audience that paid these tickets wants to see Streetcar on Broadway and see it live, it's you. You're it now. And for a whole generation of people, you're going to be Atticus Finch, which is kind of a cool thing. How do you feel about that?
Honored. I really am. Thank you. I'm honored. That means I pulled it off.
With his fresh, subtle, and emotionally grounded performance, Jeff Daniels does indeed pull it off. Do you hear that, Tony voters? I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.